I say, Doris, my darling, is it midnight the finest hour for a sumptuous picnic?
Where's the booze?
But, Doris, I thought you had put behind your sinful ways, that you aspired to rebound from your former husband with a distinguished gentleman.
The only thing distinguished about you is that you don't know how to show a girl a good time. Keep this up, and you won't be walking me home.
But, Doris, we had so many wondrous message exchanges on Match.com. Your words touched the deepest ventricles of my heart. They moved mountains. They transported me across all 7 continents.
Oh, stop bragging. You only have 4 ventricles, you dope. How deep can your heart beat anyway? And when was the last time you saw a cardiologist?
I need no heart surgeon to know how hot the blood flows.
Call me a cab, you creep.
Yes, Doris, yes. You are the taxi who shuttles me away through the sordid streets, away from my years of loneliness.
Well, I sure hope you tip well, because my husband ain't paying alimony these days.
Okay, so I am here with Nick Antosca, who is most recently the author of Midnight Picnic. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
First off, I should point out that Jackie Corley, she admitted on the Word Riot blog that she kept referring to your book as Midnight Panic as opposed to Midnight Picnic. Now, I read this book and I didn't discern any particular picnics in this book, but the closest thing that comes to mind to any kind of picnic outing is probably the mini golf game. So what of this conundrum that even your own publisher is experiencing in terms of we're panicking about picnics here?
Well, it's you know, the killer is going to take the little boy picking blackberries in the woods and promises him food. So that's the essential midnight picnic.
But you know, he doesn't actually say picnic, though.
Does it? Well, but the idea is, you know, that he's going to go take him for food. He's got food hidden out in the woods. And he's going to go eat with him late at night, and he actually, you know, a terrible thing happens out in the woods.
But I'm wondering if Jackie was discerning the sense of panic, because actually at one point I even called it Midnight Panic, and I then had to remind myself that it was indeed Picnic, so...
Well, I think that's sort of an interesting problem that readers might have. I have no problem with people calling it Midnight Panic if, you know, if that's what their mind does for them.
Yeah, but I mean, you had a very specific picnic scenario that was settled, that's deeply embedded in the book. I mean, surely that causes you some alarm, or are you not so strict or austere when it comes to reader interpretation?
No, I'm fine. People can interpret my books any way they like, especially this one, which is kind of me interpreting things out of my own head and my dreams, you know, it follows... I guess what you might call dream logic a lot more than my first book did.
Yeah.
Which my first book is a very sort of linear story where, you know, things take place roughly in the real world. And this is much more strange, exaggerated, surreal. And, you know, I think people can read it and get a lot of different things from it and go a lot of different places with it.
Was this a situation in which much of the imagery, such as, for example, the dogs that emerge from the mouth, the miniature dog babies and all that, the mouth birth dogs that you refer to, did this come from your dreams? Did most of the imagery in this book come from your dreams?
A good deal of it did. The dogs are, something that's appeared in a lot of my stuff. In almost everything I've ever written, there's a dog that is hurt or in trouble or dangerous. And I didn't realize that until I'd been writing for many years. And it took me a while to put it together. But there are a lot of things that happened to me involving dogs. I don't know if you can see it in this light. I have a scar on my face, a very light scar right there.
I can't quite see it, but I can kind of see it.
It looks like... It looks, you know, if you don't know what it is, it looks like I just slept on a crease or something in a pillow. It's a light, straight scar I got when I was 5 years old, and a dog attacked me. My dog attacked me. And then we put it to sleep. And that was one of the dogs that I grew up with. And then when I was older, I saw my dog that I had grown up with after that kill a neighbor's dog, and then we put that dog to sleep. And there was another. There are several other stories like that have sort of unconsciously, I think, informed this. And, you know, I am shocked that it took me so long to realize that I kept writing things about dogs being hurt.
Yeah.
And not just dogs being hurt, but dogs that are important to main characters or sympathetic in some way. Obviously, Midnight Picnic opens with the main character crushing his dog, basically, and then having to kill it and put it out of its misery. That is actually the original idea for Midnight Picnic, which was very different than the original seed of Midnight Picnic, comes from, you know, those sort of websites like Post Secret or Groupon.
Yes.
Where people post their secrets or things that bother them. A long time ago, years ago, I read a post on one of those sites, which was just a very short paragraph about a guy talked about how he had accidentally run over his dog, and then the dog sort of crawled away, like, half dead, and, you know, it was his, like, beloved pet, and he had to go kill it. And for some reason, that stuck with me for a long time, and I wanted to open a book with that. And what would come after that changed, you know, over the years, but eventually I started this with it, and it seemed to lead into what eventually became Midnight Picnic.
Interesting. So to a certain degree, your fiction has been about attempting to come to terms with this dog trauma, this 5-year-old incident, or this incident with you at 5.
No, that... I think that's significantly exaggerating. I think it's just a, it's just a theme or I guess the word is trope that comes up from time to time. And I try to shy away from analyzing my own stuff too much. And I think maybe that's one reason why it took me so long to even notice that dogs kept showing up that much. But
now that you're aware of it, if you type in dog into
right,
your computer,
now
it becomes
a
sort of self-conscious
additional
situation.
Weight.
Yeah.
I try not to be self-conscious about it. And the book that, the manuscript that I've been working on lately has no dogs in it. And that wasn't a conscious decision, but maybe it wasn't like I'm not going to put any dogs in this book.
You're diffident about dogs.
But maybe... maybe because I recognize it, I brought it out in the open. I didn't sort of find it as compelling anymore. So,
but going back to the mouth birth dogs, I mean, do you have any personal experience of putting your mouth around a dog?
No.
How did this come about? It's a rather extraordinary. There are 4 of them. You know?
No, I can't. I don't know where that came from. I think the idea was just that there had to be something pretty disturbing that this kid wanted to do. To the man who had killed him, and you know, I don't think it's well. I don't want to describe what the mouth birth dogs are too much for people who haven't read the book. But it's supposed to be a shocking moment in the book, and kind of disgusting and disturbing,
enthralling. I would say.
Yeah,
but
I hope it's pretty memorable. I don't know. I can't remember where the idea of them came from. I think I saw a picture of a giant continental rabbit somewhere. I think these are like rabbits that are as big as dogs, and they're like sort of cute and sort of disgusting. And for some reason, I pictured that as like half dog, and that became this image. Like I said, with this book, I was sort of willing to, like, I encouraged myself to just follow imagery where it would lead.
Is there something, for example, in the obvious spelling scenario in which dog spells God backwards, that this might be your kind of inverted way of coming to terms with a potential deity? And the fact that it comes from the mouth as opposed to from the skies, I mean, I don't know. You tell me here. Are you a religious man, Nick?
No,
okay,
not really.
Okay, so the dog is your religion then?
Well, the idea of, the dog, God, mouth, is a pretty fascinating question. I don't think that my interest in dogs has anything to do with concern about God or whether God exists. I think it's more a concern about possibly being betrayed by something that you trust and are close to and think is not going to ever harm you. You know, you think of a kid and his dog as a sort of a pure relationship. And the idea that it might turn on you and shred you is sort of compelling.
It certainly is.
The idea that you might still feel you might still feel an allegiance to that animal. You know, it's almost a cliche, the idea of like the kid being attacked by the dog, and then the parents want to put the dog to sleep, and the kid is like, no, don't do that. Which I think is kind of, you know, what I remember from when I was 5 or 6, and you know, that happened.
I'm curious if you've read Charlie Houston's books, because in every one of his novels, he does terrible things to dogs.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Every single book, he has a terrible situation in which a dog is maimed or murdered.
And I haven't. Yeah. You're gonna have to give me some.
I will. He did this great series of crime novels based around this character Hank Thompson, who gradually has a worse day with each book until he becomes gradually more psychotic as it goes on. And he did this. He has this ongoing series about vampires in New York, and there's a standalone book that's coming out in January about a crime scene cleanup. I don't know if there's any dogs in that, but I haven't read it yet. But to clean up the crime scene. Maybe you and him might want to sit down and have a talk about this.
Yeah,
this
sounds
dog
like my
fixation.
Kind of books. We'll have to check this out.
I have a sort of an ancillary question, and perhaps it might bear some reflection upon your work. I investigated the interview that Ned Vizzini did with you at Book Slut, mm-hmm. and he seemed particularly concerned with the phrase "blown your load."
Right.
Why do you think that interviewers of the Vizzini camp are so concerned with ejaculation, or associate this in some strange way with your particular work?
I have no idea. Ned and I've known Ned for years, and you know, I think we were just joking around a little bit in that interview, but. You know, Ned's a very good writer and a very good friend of mine, and I think, I think
he has some baseball here.
Yeah, he's.
That's why he would use this phrase.
Right. He tries to, you know, have do an interesting interview when it, you know, as I'm sure you're familiar with it, the incident, you want to ask something unusual or you know, maybe provoke the interviewee a little bit not in a confrontational way, but in a challenging way
or something like that.
I don't think there was any huge significance in that.
Well, I found that interview, and it was interesting, and we were talking about the notion of drinking. You would stop drinking, apparently, when you would talk to Ned during that interview. And when you have the flashback to Jacob in this, the key thing that is his major flaw is drinking.
Right.
And it becomes almost this rather absurd situation in which he's constantly given a license, despite the fact that he constantly obliterates cars. I'm curious why drinking was the natural flaw to return to. Is this your own way of, I guess, coming to terms? I mean, why was it Jacob's fatal flaw to drink and turn into a homicidal maniac?
It seemed the most human flaw that I feel like when you give somebody like a drug addiction, you kind of make it into an issue. You know, it's like with they ask Spike Lee why he didn't show drugs and do the right thing. You know, it's an inner city neighborhood. So why didn't you show drugs? He said, well, that would have been bringing a whole different element into it. That's like politicizing it. And I didn't feel like this character, like he had to have some vice. He had to have some kind of like monkey on his back. And I didn't feel, you know, I didn't think that he would be a coke addict or a meth head or anything like that. It felt like the most kind of honest and intuitive vice to give him. And I've known a couple of people like that. One of my very good friends is, you know, much older than me and a long time ago was an alcoholic and used to tell me quite a few stories about that. And this guy's a big influence on my life. And, you know, I've based a couple of characters on him, not this one, but I've also, you know, I've taken things from stories that he's told me about, you know, his youth. And put them in books. So that's where that came from.
Many of the sentences in this book are exceptionally short, and I'm curious as to why that is. Is there a certain word count in which you feel a sense of trauma kicking in that maybe, like, after about 10 words in a sentence, you feel that it's too long and that you may, you know, burst into tears? I mean, why this writing the short sentences?
No, in terms of trauma, in terms of word count, on a macro level, I find that whenever I edit, whenever I'm revising, I cut out, like, at least 10% of what's there. I mean, if I have... you know, usually more. I have this manuscript right now that I'm working on. It's, you know, it was 80,000 words when I finished. I just went through and did a revision. Now it's 70,000 words. When I was editing Midnight Picnic, I think the first draft was about 50,000 words, and the published version is maybe 40,000. It's about as short as a novel can be. It's still called a novel. And, you know, whether it's right on the border between novella and novel.
Sure.
And in terms of sentence length, I didn't go into this book intending it to be a short sentence book. I thought of it as I started writing as, I thought of it as like a ghost story, you know, if James Salter ever wrote a ghost story, and you know, something sort of like contemplative and serious. And you know, when I read it back, it doesn't seem like that to me at all. It's, you know, often you go into something with an idea of like, oh, it's going to be this meets that, and then you create something totally new that you didn't quite expect. And I feel like that's what happened here. I don't know why the sentence was that short. It just felt intuitive.
It was serious when you wrote it, and you looked back on it, and you thought it was funny? Or
No. I still think it's serious. I just don't feel like it's like a James Salter ghost story.
Got it.
You know, I don't know what I would compare it to at this point. Like, I wrote it so recently. Like, I can't go back and read anything that I've written for, like, 2 years without, you know, it's like 2 years until I can sort of assess it with any objectivity. It's like when you see a photograph of yourself that was taken a couple of days ago, you know, you don't really process it. You just see the parts, and you see that photograph, like, 2 years later, and you're like, oh, I look like that. You know, that's how I feel about my writing.
I see. I totally relate to that. I mean, you know, you get better as a writer, or you make changes as a writer, and you look back at something you wrote a long time ago, and it's, who the hell is this guy, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of my friends who are writers say things to the effect of, you know, I look at something I wrote 2-3 years ago, and I can't believe I wrote that. It's so bad. With me, it's the opposite. I look at something I wrote like yesterday or the day before, and I'm like, God, it's so terrible. Like, I can't. But what was I thinking? I look at something like I wrote 2 years ago, and I'm like, that's pretty good. I wish I could write like that now.
But
now
this is a pretty common writing set of feelings where you sometimes feel, oh, this is pretty good, and like work on the same piece later, oh, this is utter shit. You know,
yeah, I mean, of course.
So you're dealing with this then, basically.
Of course, yeah.
On everything you write.
Basically, you can, you know, you always have to take your own perception of your own work with a grain of salt.
Okay.
You know, or several.
I have to ask you about the chapter headings. They start off being fairly conventional. Chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, and then things get a little dicey after that. And there is a strike-through line, and then suddenly the numbered chapters disappear in favor of character names and other situations. What happened here?
I'm glad you asked that. Nobody else has asked that so far, which surprises me. The book starts in the world of the living that we know, and things are pretty linear. And then at the point where the chapter's titles start to change, they drift into the afterlife, which is this strange place that seems composed of geography they're familiar with and things from their memories and, you know, the Midwest and the United States just after dark. And I just wanted to create a sense of drifting and sort of the idea that the narrative was just kind of like melting. And when the chapter titles are characters' names, for the most part, early on, that's when one of the characters, Bram, is the main character, is tumbling into somebody else's memory, is experiencing someone else's memory. When he is, when he comes into contact with the ghost, this little boy, which happens at the beginning, the ghost, transfers to him the ability to experience other people's memories by contacting, by touching things they've touched. And so, you know, one of those chapters is called Adam, the name of the little boy, and he goes into this memory that Adam wants him to see, the memory of being murdered. And then later on, he goes into the memory of the murderer, and so those, you know, that's those chapters.
Well, one thing that's interesting is that there's a concern for smell of the living, but not so much with smell of the dead. You know, Adam is never described as having a particular smell, even though there is this incident, which we've alluded to earlier, that I suspect would probably smell, given the orificial nature of that moment. So, I'm curious as to why people can't smell the dead in this particular book.
You know, that's an interesting question. That is not a conscious decision on my part. I think you're absolutely right. You describe smells of, you know, the characters who are alive, especially when they're dirty and nasty.
Yeah.
And you know, the girl smells bad. She's taking a bit. I guess when people are dead, they don't smell anymore. You know, I don't know. I guess when you're wandering the afterlife, when I picture that, when I try to live in that experience, I guess there's no olfactory part, as I imagine. Maybe that's I don't know if that's good or bad. But I
also bring this up because with Nadine, the stripper, near the end of the book, there's this lap dance scenario,
right.
And Bram is not turned on in the slightest.
Right.
So it seems that a lot of senses seem to shut down here.
There's certainly a sense of numbness. There's a sense of numbness.
Even though there's rigor mortis, I mean, you know.
Well, right. The kid, you know, the encounters with the dead are not healthy for the living. Right? That's one of the things that... you know, Bram comes to realize as he goes further and further following this kid who's dead, is that what the kid is doing in using him to seek revenge is unnatural. And you know, if you wanna extrapolate a theme from the, you know, the revenge is obviously a big through line. You know, the kid numbs him and you know, numbs his senses and his sense of right and wrong. It numbs his judgment and drags him along that way. And then when he encounters his father at the end, I don't want to give, you know, too much away, but he encounters his father and sort of comes to his senses a little bit. And that's, you know, the final decision that he makes at the very end of the novel comes from that, like rising above the numbness.
Sure. I'm also curious, I mean, what is your personal experience with Roy Rogers restaurants? I mean, I have only been in one, and that was my first and last time, but I was curious as to what sensory experience you bring to the book of your own Roy Rogers dining experiences over the years, or have you even been?
There's a Roy Rogers about 5 minutes from the house where I grew up in Maryland.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
And so that was the fast food restaurant we always went to,
yeah.
And, you know, it's a very... orange, kind of weird, gross, sad place. The scene where they go to the fast food restaurant, you're talking about the scene right after when they go into the afterlife and they sit down at the fast food restaurant. I just described the restaurant that I always went to as a little kid. And much of the book, once they go into the afterlife, much of the places that they go to are all composed of, they're all places that I went to as a kid. You know, my grandmother lives in Atlantic City. I used to go there all the time. There's a scene, you know, in the book where they wander this, there's a brief scene where they wander a kind of deserted, crumbling Atlantic City. There's a glimpse of dinosaur land right when they go into the afterlife. That's a place I used to go. I was born in New Orleans. The book ends there in New Orleans, in Audubon Park. And right when I was writing, as I was writing this book, I took a trip to New Orleans. And this is a trip I was telling you about earlier, before the interview started, my friend Ned Vizzini and I actually went to New Orleans, and my godfather lives there now. And we, you know, at night we drove around. Sometimes we drove around the French Quarter. We drove around the deserted neighborhoods. This was after Katrina, and it really is. Like, Bourbon Street is bright and hopping and lively, and then a block in any direction is totally dark and strange. And you drive around other neighborhoods, drive around, like, St. Anne Street, where I was born, and it was totally dark. Just absolutely, it felt like the Wild West. I mean, there were, you know, no lights, no cops, and you would see the graffiti on the houses, and it was just very, very chilling. And we, my family left New Orleans when I was 4 or 5, and so I only have sort of very dim memories, and reconciling those with you know, the post Katrina explorations was disorienting, and I put some of that in the book. And you know, the strip club scene you mentioned, we went there. It's a famous strip club on Bourbon Street, where you can identify. There's these like mechanical legs swinging out front, very eerie, very strange, and pretty, you know, desultory once you go inside. And there's a midget in there, and that's why there was a midget glimpsed in the book.
Surreal moments are actually drawn from real life experiences, and yet there is this close association with the afterlife. Is this how memory works for you, that it's dead moments to be recalled and then placed into a narrative that involves the dead?
I don't think it's that simple, but, you know, there might be something to that, in the sense that that it seemed very natural to me to include a lot of these memories. And a lot of these memories seem very eerie to me. And there's a mention of, you know, when they go to the fast food restaurant, there's a mention of somebody they glimpse there who's dead, who was murdered. And that is somebody from my high school who was murdered just like that.
Wow,
when I was a few years older than me. I didn't know him. I just remember it was a big, it was a major murder trial in our town. Some of his friends killed him and threw him off the bridge. And things like that seem to sort of float to the surface. You know, I hadn't thought about that in years. And when I was writing this book, I write in different ways in different environments depending on what I'm writing. And with this book, I wrote almost all of it at night. I wrote it, you know, I would get home, I would go to sleep, I would get up around 10 or 11 at night, and then I would write for much of the night, and then go to sleep a little bit before dawn, and then go to work. And writing like that, you know, very isolated, sort of, or it feels very isolated. It's dark. There's nothing really to do except for, you know, hang out and write. And things just seemed to sort of rise to the surface while I was putting it together. A lot of these memories I hadn't thought about for a long time, and things that weren't particularly traumatic, but seemed to return with added significance, and it felt very correct to put them in.
I also wanted to ask you, speaking of other cultural moments, the Martian Chronicles. I take it that you grew up reading that too.
Yeah, I love the Martian Chronicles. If any specific book has influenced this, it's the Martian Chronicles, and that's why it's explicitly referenced.
Very explicitly references. Yeah. It's all over the place at one point. Yeah.
It appears, I think, twice. You know, in a book this short is pretty obtrusive. But. Yeah.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about the concern for the corporeal in this. Early on, Bram has a particular fantasy of going to Florida, and you then describe how he looks like. You describe him as having a hulking, hairy, dough-pale body with mountain man hair,
right.
And he wants to lumber down a Florida beach, causing frightened bronze people to clear a path for the Appalachian monster. Now, this is an interesting choice of phrasing, because you're implying that he may not be the Appalachian monster, because you're separating the Appalachian monster from the hairy, dough-pale boy. But that's also a very, very unusual description. So I have to ask you about little details like this. There's another moment, too, that I must point out, and it's just before a sex scene. You point out quite helpfully that Marion's breastbone is visible above her breasts, which was suggesting that either she's very shy about revealing her breastbone to people, or maybe sometimes her breastbone is not there, or maybe she's kind of in this ghostly form. But I'm wondering if you can explain why you felt it's necessary to point out the topographical location of her breastbone, whilst likewise Bram's physical description that we have just read.
Well, in the case of the breastbone, I just wanted to emphasize how skinny she was. I mean, you can see her her bones through her skin. I mean, I don't think it was anything more than that. And with Bram as described as the hulking Appalachian monster. I mean, this is pretty early in the book, and we're still getting a sense of him physically. And I just wanted to sort of, Bram, I think, I picture him as sort of a gentle giant. He's this big, like, kind of furry guy who's going to be led around later on by this tiny child. You know, I don't know. There wasn't any sort of intentional significance there beyond just, you know, a vivid description of the guy that would hopefully stick in your mind and contrast with the child who's going to show up later.
But in both of these cases, so that they can see the Appalachian monster and then above her breasts, I mean, you're basically suggesting here, I mean, it's almost like there's this clause or there's this phrase that most writers are not going to put into a sentence like this. And so, I mean, it's a very specific stylistic tick on your part, and that's why I bring up these two examples, because there are many other types of sentences like this in which you describe something, and there's almost this kind of, like, additional description just to remind us where it is, which is unlike, I mean, I liked it personally, right. But I'm just curious as to why you feel, particularly after you say that you pruned down 10% of it. I'm almost curious to see the original.
I think that actually might speak to a paranoia that I have as a writer. I'm worried about logistics all day, just in a basic way. I'm worried that people, like, that readers won't quite know what I'm talking about sometimes. And I think that comes out in unintentional ways, too. You know, I try to orient things very carefully with a minimum of words, but sometimes I sort of get tied up in the logistics. Maybe that's that informs that voice. Causes that voice.
So, I mean, so also Marion has an old-fashioned razor with frightening straight blades.
Right.
So this is interesting to me because I mean, I can understand why, you know, she'd have an old-fashioned razor, but the fact that straight blades, which if handled with care, are actually not going to necessarily be frightening. It's an interesting adjective on your part.
Maybe I was trying to. I think in that case, if I remember where the placement of that that phrase is, I was trying to foreshadow what happens to Marion, even though it doesn't involve the razor.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of surround the character with a sense of dread about where she might be headed.
When you use an adjective, do you need to place it in a place that nobody else is going to place it, like frightening straight blades, that this is the only way for you to deal with this neurosis you're describing of your concern for logistics? Or?
No, I don't think so. In terms of logistics, I'm worried about, like, readers knowing where the characters are standing in a room and think, you know, basic thing. I'm worried about blocking. I don't try to write self-conscious, you know, adjectives or self-conscious prose. So I don't think the frightening straight blades was. I mean, that doesn't seem that unusual to me. I try to create a mood, I don't think, I don't think that isn't something that would jump out at me as a reader.
Yeah.
You know, I think of, I was just telling you before, I was reading Bolaño's 2666, and there's a phrase in there, you know, I have mixed feelings about the book, but there's a phrase I remember, you talk about a character as a melancholy intellectual put out to pasture in his own field astride a capricious and childish beast. And capricious and childish beast, I mean, that's, you know, that's something that jumps out at me. And that, I think that's a great phrase, but it jumps out at me as self-conscious.
Yeah.
I try not to write things like that unless there's a very specific reason. I don't sort of think about that. You know, as I'm writing very much.
But isn't there a certain amount of self-consciousness that you can't avoid as a writer, particularly if you are trying to create a mood or even an unusual atmosphere in a particular work of fiction? That, I mean, you know, your voice is your voice.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you view the world in a slightly cockeyed manner, well, you're going to probably use what others might call self-conscious phrasing, but to you is absolutely innate, you know?
Right, right, of course. And when you're revising, you absolutely have to be self-conscious. There's just no way around it. That's what revision is. But I think the trick when you're writing a first, or when I'm writing a first draft, is to not be self-conscious. You'll never be fully unself-conscious, but I find it's most productive for me just to be intuitive, you know.
But you were conscious about the dogs earlier. You were confessing to that. So,
that's true. That's true. But I didn't make that connection until some way through the book.
Yeah.
I'm talking more here about being self-conscious about prose, about language, trying to say something smart or quirky or unusual. I just try to try to be intuitive.
Yeah, but when you're dealing
on the first draft, on a revision, you sort of have to parse everything.
Oh, I totally understand that. I totally understand what you're saying. But even on some basic level, the word dog, it's three letters.
Right.
It's something that's going to crop up. I mean, right. You know, you're almost imposing, I suppose, a self-censorship. If, for example, you are the dog guy in your
right.
books,
right.
I mean, don't you have to have an obligation to not censor or not limit yourself in this first draft phase?
Because and in fact, I certainly don't think I did. I mean, the dog, you know, I didn't take the dogs out after I realized, like, this was coming from whatever you want to call it, the canine vein in my in my personality or my history. I mean, there are dogs all through this book, and the dogs, you know, have a lot to do with how the book ends.
Yeah.
If you remember. So I don't think that wasn't problematic for me at all in Midnight Picnic. You know, in the book that I'm working on now, which has absolutely no dogs, I feel like maybe there was something, a part of me was just not as interested because I had already brought it out into the open.
But what I'm suggesting here is that you can take the Nick and Tosca out of the dogs, but you can't take the dogs out of Nick and Tosca.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's, you know, I agree with that completely. And I'm sure I'll write books with dogs again. You know, I'm sure I'll write stories with dogs for many years. When I recognized that I had this thing that was showing up again and again, I sat down and thought back to all kinds of different projects that I worked on and tried to, like, pick out the dogs in them. And, you know, in some projects, they're not that obtrusive. Like in Fire is my first novel. There's a dog in it, but in a sort of, you know, in kind of a character's memory, a character remembers that the man who molested him had a dog, and later on they go to that guy's house and they find that the dog is there, but it's been stuffed. The guy's killed the dog and stuffed it.
Yeah.
And you know, I tried to pick out the dogs and other things that I'd written. I remember a screenplay that I wrote for my thesis in college. And it was a pretty terrible screenplay. But I had to write it quickly as bizarre sci-fi thing about parallel worlds. But there's a scene where one of the villains goes to a parallel world that is far from our own, where the laws of physics and science are a little bit different, and things melt into each other, like beings can encounter each other and, you know, blend with each other and then move apart. And while he's there, a pit bull attacks him and becomes bonded with his arm, and then he returns to, as it attacks him, he's returned to reality as we know it, and for the rest of the book he has this ferocious pit bull attached to his arm that he can attack people with. I was like, wow, that
really?
Is really, I really took it far there.
Why was the pit bull the common theme throughout both parallel universes in this screenplay?
Well, he brought it back with him.
Oh,
he brought it back with him.
I got it, but I mean, if the universe was melting, this parallel universe...
I didn't really get the science down
the
perfectly.
The pit bull was not melting, I presume, and so that's...
Objects in this outer world could blend into each other. So,
yeah.
You know, if two people were walking toward each other, they could just keep walking and walk right through each other, their bodies sort of melding together and then passing, you know, passing.
But the pit bull was corporeal,
by.
Though. And the pit
right.
bull,
and
what was the food
corporeal.
Chain like? I mean, in this,
well, I don't know. Again, I didn't work out the science all that much, and it was a pretty, a screenplay of questionable quality.
You should revive this for something else, I think.
Oh, there are some ideas in it that I think I'll recycle. The first act was pretty good, enough said about that. There's a lot of screenplays that have, you know.
I know, I've written quite a few myself when I was in college. I had one where it began with a man who was in the middle of an orgy, and his girlfriend walked in on him and then proceeded to completely be violent towards him. And he spent, this is like something I wrote in like 3 days for like three college units.
Right.
And he spent the rest of the entire script being humiliated in various forms until at the end, everything erupted in nuclear explosions. So, but I got an A. I was told that it was promising, which is, anyway, I actually wanted to ask you about this this really last-minute shift from Impetus to Word Riot.
Yeah.
I know you've been asked about it multiple times, and this is a general question, but I do think it's important in light of the current publishing climate, so maybe you can talk about this a little bit.
To summarize, Impetus Press published my first novel, Fires, and... Then agreed to publish Midnight Picnic even before it was finished. And then we started putting it together. It was going to come out October 31st of 2008. And I was going on vacation the weekend before that, I guess. And I got a call from them. They were going under. They were closing their doors. Because they were ambitious and they had run up a lot of debt and returns were killing them and they just sort of like couldn't keep publishing realistically. It was sad. It was too bad. They worked hard and they were really good to me. Fires was a lot of fun. Like we worked together really closely and it was a pleasure to do it. But things went under, and I was, I've been getting worried sort of in the weeks, months, coming up to that, increasingly worried, but I didn't know they were going to go under. It took me by surprise. And the proofs, everything was done for Midnight. It was basically ready to go, and they looked around to try and find anybody else who might be interested in putting it out. And I've known Jackie, on and off for a while. I think we first met, we did a reading together when I was in college, and she had just started Word Riot Press, and that was years ago. And Jackie stepped in within a couple days, and Word Riot took Midnight Picnic, they published it in like 2 months.
Yeah. No editing, I presume.
No edit. No, they took the stuff that Impetus had put together and just we're ready to go.
Yeah. But legally speaking, I mean, were there any thorny issues in terms of getting the rights back from Impetus? Did you have to pay out to them in any way?
No. Impetus was really helpful. Willie Blackmore was really great about finding a new home. He wasn't worried about kind of like getting them money, anything like that. So I just signed a contract with Jackie, and we're good. It was kind of startling. I mean, it was depressing at first, obviously, and then a huge relief when Jackie took it over. And they're both very good presses. Impetus was a very good press. Word Riot. It's good press. I feel like they have very different styles. I feel like Impetus was kind of the Clintons and Word Riot is Obama. That's
their
style.
But who was the Bush? There was no Bush in your life.
Thank God there was no Bush. I jumped right from one Democratic administration to the next.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you going to stick with Word Riot for this third offering that you're in the middle of?
We haven't even begun to discuss anything like that. I would love to work with Jackie again. I have no idea what's going to go on. We haven't even talked about anything like that. For 2 months we've been in a crush to get this book out. So
are you concerned about the current publishing climate? I mean, I was at the small press fair and I was actually trying to hawk DVDs of this show, and people didn't have money, and a lot of booksellers there were just sitting there, essentially there in promotional capacity. very little products.
You know,
being
it is a scary time. Yeah. I my day job is I work at a hedge fund, and it's scary all over New York. I'll tell you that it's. You know, I'm glad I have a day job and that I don't depend on writing to, you know, pay my rent. You know, there are big pros and cons to having a day job for an artist, but the place where I work is sort of known as a refuge for writers. There's a lot of other writers who work there or have worked there. You know, it means I have to go to work every day, which I don't love, but... you know, it's a good job, and I'm very happy that I don't depend on writing to, you know, and it means that the money, you know, the money that I do make writing is like gravy. I mean, it's money that I can actually enjoy because I don't have to pay, like, you know, pay off my student loans with it or yeah. like just immediately send it off to debtors. Creditors.
But I suppose my question is more about, you know, this idea of whether Midnight Picnic will sell because people have very little money and perhaps they're putting it into, I suppose, more boring books for the Christmas season or more dependable stocks, I suppose. Do you worry that this is a bad time for you to be releasing this book? And simultaneously, to talk about your writing, this is the second question I'll throw at you. I mean, the New York Sun, of course, folded.
Right.
And you were reviewing for them fairly frequently. Are you still reviewing it?
I hadn't been reviewing for them for a while before they went under.
Oh, yeah.
I was reviewing a lot when Tom Meany was the book's editor there. And then later on, you know, I stopped reviewing for them. But they had a great art section, you know, that was fun while I was doing it. Yeah. But I haven't done book reviewing for a little while. I've been focusing on, A Midnight Picnic for a while, and then this new book that I've been writing, and Ned Vizzini and I have been collaborating on writing a screenplay, a TV show.
Okay.
So I've been pretty busy doing, just like fiction writing. But am I worried about the book being released now? No, because I don't expect to make a lot of money on any of my books. I've never made a ton of money off books. You know, that said, the sort of response, the book hasn't even been released yet. At the time we're doing this interview, the book is going to be released in a couple of days. And there's already been a bunch of orders. And, you know, I'm surprised and happy. You know, we're going to do some promotion and, what happens is going to happen. You know, I'm not sort of anxious at all about, you know, will this book sell? I think that it will. I think especially by standards of independent books, it'll do fine. I'm anxious, you know, I'm always anxious about like future books, like will I finish these books I want to finish? Then will they sell? And will somebody publish them? Of course, I'm always anxious about that. Like any writer is, you know, unless you're, you know, whatever.
I mean, I would not bring the subject up if we weren't in the middle of essentially the publishing apocalypse.
Yeah, right. Was it yesterday or the day before that every publisher fired, like, you know, 10% of their workforce is just like
pretty much with the exception of Hachette, which has been profitable, and Norton, I know, is doing all right.
Hachette was James Patterson, right?
Yeah, exactly. There was a recently announced before I got here. There was like a Macmillan wage freeze for anybody who makes over 50,000. So
every once in a while, I'm glad I work in finance. Not often, but once in a while, there's. But yeah, I don't know. I've always wanted to be a writer. I'll always be a writer. Money is an incidental factor. Believe me, I would love to make lots of money, but off my books. But it's not the concern is like, will I still be getting published in X number of years? That's how I think about it. And you know, people. This book is getting published right now. I'm happy. So you know, people are reading it. Jackie sent out the. You know, the book isn't released until Monday, but Jackie sent out the first books a few days ago, and people just got them, I guess, a few days ago. So I'm excited.
Well, Nick, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thank you, Ed.
All right, thanks. Another night out, another girl on the scene. It's art with a heart, you know the kind I mean. Tell me why it is they all study art. Underage and overdressed, I can't tell them apart. Over here's got a little something else. All of that is money, and she fancies herself. Says she's 21, she's probably 16. Got a dirty mouth, at least.